talk smack, and drink bourbon.
Ed told me, he said, well, let me tell you how we're going to do delegation meetings. I'm going to tell you what to tell the other ones, and that's the delegation meeting. But
ladies and gentlemen, dear listeners, it is hard to believe, but this is the 51st episode of Bourbon in the Back Room. We've got an incredible, very special guest today, longtime friend of your hosts, but also one of the most important leaders in the state of South Carolina. Can't wait to get to that, Joel, but first, we're going to do some updates on what's happening in South Carolina. But before we do that, listeners, remember, send us your comments. Send us an email at bourboninthebackroom@gmail.com or just hop on Facebook or Twitter, BITBR podcast. We're getting so many great comments lately and suggestions for guests as we wind up the legislative session here last week. We've got a lot of talk about going into the next few weeks, and then this summer we'll have some more special guests. So let's right now go to our co-host, Joel Lurie, to talk about what's happening in South Carolina politics and government.
All right, Vincent. So a lot of interesting things happening. First, I want to take you to an article that ran this week by Joe Bustos of the state newspaper talking about Nikki Haley and Tim Scott, both prominent national Republicans, both showing up in, of all places, Iowa, have plans to go there next month. And they did an interesting interview with Senator Scott. He was in Myrtle Beach for some sort of Republican conference meeting recently, and they were asking him questions. And I want to play just about 45 seconds and get your response.
If Trump runs in 2024, will you support him?
Of course.
And would you step aside and potentially not run for president, of course?
Well, I'm not running for president at this point at all. So I'm not going to answer a hypothetical question that gives people something to write about.
How do you think their party comes together ahead of the coming elections?
Well, actually, I think the party's already come together, to be honest with you. One of the reasons why I started my entire conversation off this morning about the fact that a divided Republican Party is a road to socialism is because I'm starting to see our party is waking up to the reality that we are that firewall. And so I'm excited to see that we are more unified today than we have been in years, frankly. It's one of the things that you, when you're in a very entrepreneurial type party, everybody has their own ideas, but our idea is collectively is saving this country from socialism that unites us.
Vincent, first of all, a couple interesting things in those comments by Senator Scott. Number one, do you think if Donald Trump does not run, do you think Tim Scott is a presidential candidate in 2024?
I have no idea, but our friend Mick Mulvaney says yes. I don't know.
Did Mick say yes? I think Mick.
Mick said he thought.
Did he?
That,
yeah.
That Tim might run and should run, and that he would encourage him to run if Trump doesn't run.
And it was interesting to hear Senator Scott talk about sort of the party coming together and that a divided Republican Party is the beginning of socialism.
Whatever.
I'll tell you this, Vincent. I watched some of those primaries across the country this week, and that Republican Party in Pennsylvania does not look like they're unified right now. Dr. Oz on the ballot, leading the ticket.
You know, it's such a wacky world out there. I don't even know what to say. Tim, I think, you know, of course, wants to paint a rosy picture. There is truth, though, that the party that does not occupy the White House tends to be more unified than the party that does occupy the White House. And, you know, on the Democratic side, at least nationally, I mean, there's some pretty huge divides going on as well. It really feels like there's four parties right now in the country, two on each side.
That's interesting. Yeah, that is very interesting.
So. Yeah, we'll see what happens.
All right, breaking news this week. Old friend of mine, we served in the House with him. He came back and served in the Senate. Senator Scott Talley, good guy from Spartanburg, has announced after 16 years, not continuous, but remember he served in the House, went home, came back and served in the Senate. Will not run for re-election. And I was texting with Scott the other day and just said, Scott, trust me, you will find that life after politics is amazing. What do you think? Talley represents sort of the middle of that caucus, doesn't he?
Yeah, so Scott and I came into the House of Representatives at the same time in the year 2000. I always tell the story, I thought I'd be the youngest House member. I walked in our new member orientation, I think I was 29, and there's this guy who's like 22. And it was Scott Talley. So here was Scott's dilemma, Scott Talley's dilemma, and of course, he and I talk just like y'all do from time to time. But I asked another friend of ours, hey, what do you think was really going with Scott? Why didn't he run? And he said, Vincent, do you blame him? It's not like he's in Charleston running as a Republican. He is in Spartanburg County, which has become extremely to the right. Scott Talley is a pretty moderate guy. Does he really want to go through a primary with a bunch of freaking crazy people in a Republican primary or just move on with life? I think he's chosen to just move on with life.
Yeah, some things aren't worth fighting for. And I think he realized that there is a better life ahead of him.
But it's a shame because we need smart, moderates, smart and moderate Republicans in the South Carolina.
And we're going to have a special one as our guest today.
We are, one from the PD of South Carolina.
All right, moving right along. I want to take you, Vincent. There was quite an exchange while we were down at Bourbon filming our Sonny Dye episode.
Well, Joel, let me just pause. I hope our listeners all caught that episode. If you didn't, listeners, you need to go back and listen to our Sonny Dye episode at the restaurant Bourbon. It was a blast.
Once you got to your fourth old-fashioned, you really were slurring badly, but I'm just going to
I thought it was your fifth glass of wine.
Okay, but it was fun. But anyway, a battle of two good friends of ours, Brad Hutto and Dick Karpootlian, talking about the USC restructuring bill. As everybody knows by now, the clock ran out on the bill.
Yeah.
And last week or the week before, we predicted that we were hearing some things that they may not get this to the finish line.
Well, it's what I still love about state government. You can have two people in the same party who are just going at it, hammer and tongs.
And,
right?
And here's a little bit from our friend Brad Hutto and Dick Karpootlian. Thursday afternoon around 4:40 before the Senate is set to adjourn at 5 p.m. Sonny Dye.
Senator from Richland.
Senator, we met this morning. We discussed a number of different alternatives. I've been talking to you for the past couple of weeks. My question is this. Is there any first of all, are you going to support the bill as it currently is? Are you opposing it?
Currently is? No, yeah. I'm not.
And, I mean, we talked about a number of different alternatives. What would your bill look like?
I think it would look very close to what Senator Young proposed in Amendment 9.
But?
Well, the but is, it just like we've seen all day long, it's the last day of the session, and I have conferred with leadership in the House, and I just don't believe it. 20 minutes till 5,
but,
that we got any assurance.
You began speaking on this yesterday.
Yes. We didn't have Amendment 9. We didn't meet until this morning, Senator.
I mean, your position is...
I understand your frustration. It's 20 minutes till 5. It's not going to happen. Just a good discussion for where we go next year. A lot of good came out of the discussions. I understood more about what you were concerned about after our meeting this morning. I understand, after meeting with Senator Talley and Senator Young, what the committee heard over the time that they've been working on this.
Does your decision... in opposition to any change, because we don't do anything in the next 20 minutes, it will status quo. Is that based on...
No, sir. That's wrong as a supposition. Nothing is going to change anyway. Everybody who is currently on the board is going to stay on the board.
Until election next year.
What? Not even then. They have a term. If we had the
legislation
election,
would change that.
Right. And when we come back in January, there's time to change that.
So, Vincent, Senator Hutto was not a supporter of the bill, and you can see the frustration in Senator Harpootlian's face and hear it in his voice. But, you know, one thing I love about Brad Hutto, and I don't know that I agree with him on this, I felt like there's something needs to happen with that board, but he exercises his right as a senator. He can hold up a bill. Brad, as we've discussed, is one of the smartest guys in the Senate. And this exchange goes on for about 6 minutes, and Harpootlian is really going after him. And Brad, I've never seen Brad get his feathers ruffled. He does not lose his temper at all, does he?
Well, of course, these are both friends of ours, and Dick Harpootlian is a rhetorical master.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, he can make it happen, but Brad Hutto is a legislative master. When those two types meet, the legislative master wins, and that's exactly what happened, because Brad Hutto— is rarely beat.
Does that bill, so let's talk about it. So do they come back next year? Here, just to kind of bring our listeners up to date, so what is the current status? The current status is you got five USC board members who have not been reported out favorably to go to the floor of the joint assembly, the House and the Senate, to be confirmed or
right,
to be voted
for,
on.
For re-election. For re-election, the board. Right. So they will continue in a holdover status because they haven't been replaced.
Kind of serve at will at this point.
They serve until they're replaced.
Yeah.
And you know, the question will be next year when they get in the legislature, or was it included in the sign and die resolution?
No.
Ah, I see. Okay, no. So next year when they get in, will they take up a reform bill for USC and change things, or will they vote on the really vacant seats that are being held interimly by the incumbent members?
It'll be interesting because, as you know, both legislators and the general public can sometimes have a short attention span.
Well, here's the thing, though. This is not – first of all, the USC board is not healthy, and this unknown – is not healthy for the board or the university. Something needs to happen. Something needs to break. I hope it'll happen early next session.
Yeah, I was getting ready to say, you know, what is the burning issue when they come back in January? A lot of, in my opinion, Vincent, a lot depends on what happens in the next 6 months. The press smells blood in the water, right? So if USC burps in the wrong direction, it's going to be a front page story,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So we'll see what happens. Vincent, one or two other items real quick here for you. In looking at some of the most significant legislation passed this year, I want to do a quick shout out to our good friends, State Representative Beth Bernstein and Senator Darrell Jackson, who led the family leave bill and has been written up all over the state and the country that provides our state employees extra time off. When a child is brought into the family.
A great issue, bipartisan support. Our Republican friends and Democratic friends really showed how you can get things done together. And then I think our guest, who will come on the show later today, will talk about the fact that I believe 124 House members are close to that voted for an election reform bill.
Yeah, so it, even in this hyper-partisan time that we live in, it's just refreshing. It's nice to see things, the bodies come together and pass some bills that really have an impact.
Yeah,
you know?
It is.
All right, Vincent, we're going to close with your favorite subject, the race to replace
Nancy Mace.
Okay, so two big things happened in the last week. The first one, Congresswoman Mace was campaigning on Sullivan's Island, and she knocked on the door, and her staff had set this up, and I want to just give a quick shout out. She knocks up the door, and they're standing to greet her. In this home is Charleston software entrepreneur Patrick Bryant, her boyfriend for the last couple of years, and they got engaged. So here we are, bourbon in the back room. We want to congratulate Congresswoman Mace and Patrick Bryant on their pending engagement.
Congratulations. And I'll say Nancy Mace must be a really good person, because if I had done that with my wife, she would have said no.
But also happening in that race, Katie Arrington has released her first TV spot, and I'd like to play a clip for you, Vincent, because it won't shock you. But, of course, they mentioned Donald Trump. Here we go. Katie Arrington's first campaign spot.
Whether it's a lust for power or arrogant desire for notoriety, it seems like nowadays politicians are only there to serve themselves. We need to elect servant leaders like Katie Arrington. Katie will donate her salary to charity, reject congressional health care and retirement benefits, and term limit, a pro-life, pro-Second Amendment, fiscal conservative. Plus, she's Donald Trump's choice.
Katie Arrington is a fighter for the people of South Carolina.
Totally agree, Mr. President.
I'm Katie Arrington, and I approve this message.
So I think we're all anxious to see, and we're going to dig into one of the other congressional races in the next week. But I think we're all anxious to see in Charleston, in a Republican primary, does the Trump endorsement carry the day? Or are there some Republicans down there, centrist Republicans, whatever, that are turned off by the Trump endorsement? And how does this all shake out in a couple weeks? Because we are literally a couple weeks away.
We are. And, you know, that commercial you just played is trying to ride a narrative about Nancy Mace that, frankly, there was a really terrible article in Politico about Nancy Mace and her losing all of her staff or much of her staff and being focused on herself and not on constituents or issues. So I'm guessing that's part of why they're trying to create that narrative or continue that narrative in the ad. I think it's probably a low turnout race. Maybe I'm wrong. We'll see. And I don't know who that favors. I don't know if that favors which one it favors. Does it favor the diehard Trump voters who come out and vote?
I think a low turnout race favors the challenger.
Well, it could
I do
be.
Because it's the diehard Trump voters that may be motivated by this commercial.
Remember, we have a Democratic gubernatorial primary that seems like everybody's forgotten about, but there is a Charleston native in that primary. So does that keep the independent voter from going to vote in the Mace primary for Mace potentially, or do the independent voters not like Mace anyway? So who knows? It is a very odd dynamic down there right there in this race.
It's crazy. We've been talking about it for a few months, and it's kind of playing out exactly like we thought it would. Vincent, we've got a great guest. Let's take a break, pay some bills, and we'll be right back.
Joel, I'm really excited to hear that we have another new sponsor of Bourbon in the Back Room. Tell our audience who it is.
So, Vincent, let me tell you and all of our listeners about South Carolina's only locally based health insurance company, Blue Cross Blue Shield of South Carolina, one of our sponsors of Bourbon in the Back Room. They've got all your health insurance needs covered through all stages of life. Whether it's individual and family coverage, group coverage, or Medicare, you can count on Blue Cross for quality health insurance close to home. In fact, South Carolinians have counted on Blue Cross, you ready for this, Vincent? For 75 years.
Wow.
So if you need health insurance, let Blue Cross take care of you, your family, or your employees.
Welcome, Blue Cross Blue Shield, to Bourbon in the Back Room.
All right, we'll be right back.
Joel, I'm really excited. We have a special guest, a longtime friend of both of us. I think one, your classmate when you came into the General Assembly in long time ago in 1998.
The great class of 98. That also included not only our guests, but minority leader in perpetuity, Todd Rutherford. He's like the minority leader forever. Let's see, Ann Park, the late, great Dr. Jimmy Bales is in that class.
Wow, that is a great class. Yeah, I shared a delegation membership in both Chesterfield, Kershaw, well, all three, Chesterfield, Kershaw, and Lancaster with our guests for 20 years. Our guest is none other than Speaker of the House, Jay Lucas, who is from Hartsville and has served in the South Carolina General Assembly since 1998 and was the first rural Speaker of the House since our friend and my uncle Bob Shaheen. Jay Lucas, it is great to have you on the show.
Well, Vincent and Joel, it's an honor to be here. Thank you all for asking me today. I was listening to your opening comments, and Joel, I remember the 98 class. What a great class. You know, now there are only two of those folks left, Todd and Jackie Hayes, but that was
I forgot about Jackie.
Yeah, yeah.
Dillon County.
Was in 1999, the famous video poker year where David Beasley ran against Jim Hodges.
That's right.
And in the House, in that group, there were three Republicans elected and 12 Democrats.
Isn't that crazy? Think about that, listeners, for just a minute. I've heard Jay tell the story about, and we'll talk a little bit more about it, Jay, but you won a squeaker thanks to the Bethune, right, in 1998 against a Democratic opponent in a district that I don't think a Democrat would probably get 42% in now. It was a different time, but you guys made a lot of friendships across the aisle that lasted you your lifetime.
Oh, I did. You know, I was in four counties, and I was the only Republican in four counties, and it didn't take me long to understand that, you know, you really had to work with people to get anything done, because clearly I wasn't going to get anything done without the help of my delegation members. But getting back to what Joel and I were talking about, there were so few Republicans in that class, they never took a class picture of us with the speaker.
Well, let me tell you a funny story about that, Jay, just to show you how smart your friend Jay Lucas is and what a visionary he is. I don't know if I remember this like it was yesterday. Jim Hodges was governor. And, you know, the Democrats were only, what, 5 or 6 votes away from taking back the majority in the House. And I can't remember the lady's name, but she switched parties over in West Columbia, and then Kenny Bingham beat the hell out of her in that election. But I remember coming up to Lucas's block building office. And you know, when you're a freshman House member in the block building,
you barely know where to go.
Right. I mean, I've seen closets bigger than our offices, right? And Lucas, we were sitting there, and we were both, it was Girl Scout cookie week. We were sitting eating some Girl Scout cookies in your office. And I said, Jay, you know, we're friends. I've really enjoyed getting in. And by the way, I've known Jay's wife and brother-in-law. They grew up here in Columbia. I said, you know, by the way, I think it's great. I mean, I think we're going to win some seats. And we're going to take over. And I'd love to be part of a group to go over to Hartsville and make your announcement where you switch parties.
Wait a minute, he made the right choice.
Switch parties, and Lucas looks at me, and you know, and I've always thought Lucas is just one of those guys. He won't say a whole lot, and he'll lick at you, and you know, there's something churning in his mind, and he says, you know, I think I'm just going to stay where I am. We would not be calling you Mr. Speaker today had you listened to my bad advice.
Well, after I won the election, my 98 election, right. Which most people don't know I lost.
you tell the story, Walt, but we're going to get to some other things. But listeners, let me just say, this is going to be an episode of memories, I promise you. Tell this story, Jay, because it's great about your first election.
Well, so we're up about 12 at night, and we were waiting for the Kershaw boxes to come in, Vincent.
Kershaw County rules the world.
And so we had Cassett and Bethune outstanding, and it was razor thin. So they gave us the Cassett numbers, and they reversed them.
And tell the listeners your opponent was?
Individual named Tony Floyd.
Ran as a Democrat.
Lawyer. Right.
Democrat. Yeah. And he's a real good guy. Yeah. You know, he's the president at Mars Hill College now. Yeah. But Bethune, actually, most people voted, write in. Because they actually got a paper ballot because there was a school board issue.
Okay.
So there were like 50 or 60 votes out there. But I went home thinking I had lost. And I was watching one of the news channels last night and said, well, we'll have a recount. Says, nobody ever wins on a recount. You don't ever come back to win. And, you know, dadgum, if they didn't count the votes up and like 2 days later, they said, well, Jay, we think you might have won by 17 votes. And then we had protest, and you and I were up there for freshman orientation.
Right.
And I got sued or whatever, and I had to leave. So, you know, everybody's been seated. You know, all the desks are taken. Everybody's been sworn in. And, you know, I come in a couple of days later because they finally got mine done. And I think the only desk left was the one next to Dan Tripp. So I got to sit across the aisle from Dan Tripp in the Greenville delegation. But, you know, I did. I tell the young representatives all the time, you know, it doesn't matter
how you start.
How you start.
Right.
It's what you do and how you end up.
Right.
I mean, I was literally the 124th guy to take a seat. and who would have known that I would have become speaker all those years later?
All right, Jay, let's talk a little bit about how you got involved in government politics. I mean, you had a background in local government. You lived in South Carolina.
Didn't you work for the Salibi Law Firm at one time, Jay?
And then you became a lawyer, right? So just tell our listeners a little bit about how you got into all this.
Well, I was graduated law school. I actually worked for 5 years. I got a master's degree in public administration, and I went to work in Bennettsville as their finance director, and I was the county attorney in Winsboro.
Rural county.
Fairfield County, yeah. Right, and so, you know, that was really great experience. But, you know, I saved up my money. We didn't have a lot of money at the time, and I went back to law school. And I spent a couple of years after I graduated law school at these big firms in Columbia. And then I ended up going back to work with Ed Salibi.
Tell our listeners who Ed Salibi was.
Ed Salibi was a longtime powerful Democrat in the South Carolina Senate who was my good friend till the day he died.
Great guy, good friends with my dad. He was chairman of banking and insurance.
Right. So and you actually in later years, I remember you drove Senator Salibi to the state house every day, right?
Well, we'll talk about that. So after we found out I had won the election, you know, Mike Baxley,
right,
who I was going to replace, drove Ed. He'd pick him up on Tuesday, and he'd bring him back on Thursday.
Mike was a Democratic House member.
House member. And, you know, I thought it was would be a really nice thing if I went in, because Ed and I were close. Okay. He did not like the fact that I ran as a Republican.
Right.
He was mad as fire about that, and he didn't support me. So, you know, I went in his back door, and I said, Ed, you know, still want to be your friends. You've been friends with my family for years. And, oh, by the way, I'll be happy to drive you to Columbia. I'll just take Mike's place. And he liked that.
Nice.
So for 2 years, we'd go back and forth. And I'd say, Ed, don't you think we need to have a delegation meeting?
You know, he was from the school of Don Holland. We didn't have delegation
meetings. And Ed told me, he said, well, let me tell you how we're going to do delegation meetings. I'm going to tell you what to tell the other ones, and that's the delegation meeting. But it came around, and Joel, I served 2 years, and obviously I was the number one guy on the hit list for the Democrats.
Right.
I was like a tier five candidate,
right,
which means, one, they don't give you money, and two, they very rarely return your calls. They just check
kind of wrote you off.
Right? Oh, yeah. So, yeah. You know, I knew I didn't have much of a chance the next election. And Ed Salibi, you know, told the local guys and the state guys, he said, listen, you know, Jay Lucas is my friend, and you aren't going to run anybody against
him.
And if you do, I will never give the Democratic Party any more money.
Wow.
So,
you ran unopposed in 2000?
I've been unopposed since 98.
Yeah, he's the only House member to run for 20-something years unopposed.
Here's Shaheen and Lurie over here, who both got lots of campaign scars. You know, there was a guy, I'm fairly certain. Y'all remember Converse Chellis?
Oh, yeah.
Converse.
Gone.
Yep. He ultimately became state treasurer when Treasurer Ravenel had some issues to work out. But I don't think he ever had an election.
Wow.
And here's Jay Lucas over here.
I know.
Speaker of the House.
Well,
and he
let's
had
just
one...
say that Jay was smart enough to have a House district between four counties where it was almost impossible for anybody else to run. Let me also just say that Jay carried that spirit of bipartisanship forward that he learned from Senator Salibi. Joel, when I ran for the House, when I ran for the Senate in 2004, Jay was my partner in the Bethune Chicken Strut Parade during that campaign. And I know he caught hell for it, but he said he wanted to do it with me. We were in the parade. It was the first event I had, Jay, during that Senate campaign. And Jay not only was there as a Republican in the car with me, but he taught me how to throw candy and wave to the crowd. You want to tell the listeners about how you taught me to wave to the crowd?
Yeah, I kind of hate to do this because it's a little embarrassing for you that you never learned your proper parade wave. So there's a general parade wave. And then if somebody calls your name,
right. You
point at them.
Right.
And then if somebody says, Vincent or Jay, thank you for doing such and such, you give them the thumbs up. So it's kind of a three-wave approach that Vincent did not know how to do, and I'm so glad I was able to teach him that.
And in a rural parade, never, 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 never run out of candy, or what happens, Jay?
Oh, you'll get booed at the end. It's brutal at the end, and you're not going to get any votes the next time around.
Well, Ms. Speaker, the I learned how to do that a little bit differently, and of all people, I learned – when you greet people, you know, I've been with my dad all the time, who had a memory like an elephant. He could remember everybody's names. But when I was working on the Nick Theodore campaign, you know, 1986 lieutenant governor, 1990 lieutenant governor, 1994 governor. Remember, he barely lost to David Beasley. Nick couldn't remember everybody's name. So if you were a guy, it was, and then somebody said, hey, Nick, you say,
buddy.
How you doing, buddy?
Buddy.
And if you were a girl, it's, hey, honey, how you doing?
I remember that well. Jay, tell the listeners why you got into politics, why you decided to make that move from your law practice. And also, you were in a pretty Democratic area. You're not a fierce partisan. Why'd you decide to run as a Republican back then in 98?
You know, Vincent, I still ask myself that question to this day. I mean, I'm not sure. Actually, the Republican Party recruited me, and I had turned them down four, five, six times. Because,
wow. You
know, in Darlington County and in the PD area where I live, it's, you know, politics is not cutthroat. It's more of a gentleman's sport. It's changing a little bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, just to give the people a chance, you know, they never had a Republican run. And you know, I'm a center right guy, and it appeared that the Democrats had already chosen who they wanted to run. So, you know, after the eighth time of meeting with the party apparatus, I decided to give it a shot. Nobody showed me the numbers. Mm. Nobody showed me what an impossible task
right. That
I had to do. You know, campaign. You know better than anybody. Campaigning in a rural area is hard. It's Joel, brutal. I know you don't understand that. I mean, you go house to house to house very quickly.
I used to kid Joel. He could walk a neighborhood and touch the same amount of people I touch in a whole county.
Yeah. Tracy let me out in Angeles one time.
Oh, this is a good story. Go ahead, tell
Tracy
story.
Let me out
Chesterfield in Chesterfield County, Angeles.
Yeah, Chesterfield County. He let me out in Angeles. I'm going to say, I'm going to go to every house in Angeles. Well, I was there from 8 to 5. And I went to 10 houses because it was like a quarter mile between each house. That's one of the problems with campaigning in a rural area.
Tell them about how, you know, the border and how that affected us when we campaigned.
The border. Oh, yeah. North Carolina?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he and I ran up in Pageland. And, you know, I'm on one side of the street. I'm in South Carolina. I went on the other side of the street, which was in North Carolina, and I was asking for votes in North Carolina. So, you know, so some nice lady said, son, I'd like to vote for you, but I live in North Carolina.
So, Jay.
But then Joel doesn't know anything about that because he's got these nice compact.
My goal was 15 homes an hour. You know, you couldn't do 15 homes in a week.
That, you know, the distance between houses and dog bites are what separates you. Tracy would be in our green truck, and she'd see me come around the corner just running as hard as I could, and there's this dog would be on me. So you can't get in the car, so you got to dive in the back. So and she liked that. She thought it was funny. I mean, I've been asking somebody for a vote, and their dog comes up and just bites you on the back, and you're bleeding into your shoe, and you're still asking for the vote.
You're bleeding, and they go, sorry, Sonny, I'm a Democrat.
I love this dog.
If you're in rural South Carolina, 24 years ago, you would get I hadn't voted for a Republican since Eisenhower.
I mean, it was still Roosevelt voters. I remember being in Chesterfield County knocking on the door.
That's so crazy.
I knocked on the door of a white lady in Chesterfield County, and she said, are you a Democrat or Republican? Now, Kershaw, when they asked me that, I knew I was in trouble because they were always going to say, I only vote for Republicans. And this lady, I said, I'm a Democrat. She said, thank God. If it weren't for FDR, when I was my daddy died, and he sent us those checks to get us through, we would have never made it. I only vote for Democrats. Now, that generation is long gone, as Joel and I certainly know.
Isn't that
amazing?
But
it was amazing to see. It wasn't that long ago.
All right, Jay, I want to take you to middle of March this year. If you'll just join us on the TV screen here, you go down to the well of the house and you have some comments to make. And I'd like to play these for our listeners and get your response.
It's important for me that I always be completely forthcoming with the men and women of this chamber. And I had intended for you to be the first to know. I intended for you to be the first to know about my time frame and how it affects this body. That is why I'm announcing that I will not seek another term in the South Carolina House of Representatives. In another speech on a different day, I will speak to how much all of you mean to me, how much I love you, say my goodbyes and my thank yous. When it ends, I will miss it every day. I will miss all of you in countless ways. I can only hope that each of you believes that I have been a worthy servant of this chamber and worthy of the job you have so graciously bestowed upon me. My time will come to an end as this session ends.
Mr. Speaker, that was March the 15th, and that was really about 2 months ago. Talk to us a little bit about what was going through your head giving this speech. You can just see your face and body filled with emotion, but even what led to this decision? Because I think it's really important for our listeners to understand how somebody who sits in arguably the most powerful seat in state government decides it's time to move on.
Yeah. Joel, it was an emotional time for me to give that speech to devote yourself to something for 24 years, to be speaker for 8, speaker pro tem for 4, you know, that's a lot of time that you have up there. I guess the things that made me think about, hey, maybe it's time to get out, is you kind of look at the cast of characters around you. You know, when I came in, my suite mates were Merle Smith and Gary Simrell and Leon Stavronakis and Greg Delaney became my best friend.
Greg from Chesterfield.
Wonderful.
Democrats and Republicans.
And you know, so the guys I had through the 8 years were intensely loyal to me. Mm-hmm. We weren't coworkers, we were friends. And to look around and see that you know, Greg was no longer there, to see that Gary was not going to be there. And I by no means want to portray my 8 years as Camelot. There were some rough patches. There's always rough patches,
sure,
in politics.
Absolutely.
But you know, just to look around and see that, you know, hey, the guys you came in with, they're gone. The guys who always had your back, you know, they're not going to be there. The people who are coming in now are much, much younger than you, and you don't have relationships with those folks. And Greg Delaney, who had left them 4 years earlier,
told me on his own terms while he was chairman of Judiciary.
Mm-hmm. He told me that I would know, mm-hmm, when it was time. Nobody would have to tell me. And I did. I just felt that it was time to move on, to do something else. I did not plan to stay for 24 years.
No, you threatened not to run for re-election
every two years. I tell people I was not going to run, but right. You know, I'm Speaker Pro Tem, and I'm driving down the road in, what is it, August of 14, maybe? Uh-huh. And I get a phone call.
Yeah.
You know, most people get elected,
right,
to the speaker. I got a call,
yeah,
that said, hey, Jay, because of, you know, things that happened with the prior speaker, you're going to have to be speaker.
Well, why don't you just clean that up a little bit. Let's take our
listeners back to that time, Jay Lucas, because you were the Speaker Pro Tem, and frankly, traditionally, that's kind of a dead-end job, not in the sense of that it's not an important job, but just that's where most Speaker Pro Tems finish their career as Speaker Pro Tem.
Exactly.
And you were in that position in much part because everybody, I won't say everybody, but most people really loved you in the House, and it was a good spot for you to be in. But that wasn't the end of the career, your career. In a way, you were in the right place at the right time, not just for your own career, but for the state, because we were going through a scandal in the House of Representatives, and a very trusted figure needed to be there to take the reins. And in my mind, that's what happened. But tell our listeners a little about that time in 2014.
So I get a call in August of 2014 that Bobby Harrell, the current speaker, had been suspended from office. You know, I like Bobby. I wasn't particularly close to him, but he was really always good to me as far as letting me preside. I even nominated him, you know, that year to be the speaker. He had asked me to do that.
Just for our listeners to remember, Bobby Harrell was the chairman of Ways and Means. He was from Charleston. He was elected speaker when David Wilkins left. And so you're the Speaker Pro Tem. He's the speaker.
Right. And so, you know, apparently I didn't read the manual very well, but if the speaker got suspended, the Speaker Pro Tem had to step up. So they call me up and they say, you know, you're going to have to be the acting speaker. And I got, are there no other candidates?
Wait a minute, can you say that again?
Yeah, I mean, it's really not something.
So what year is this again, guys?
Yeah.
14.
Okay.
So it's really, you know, not something I aspired to do. Vincent, is like you said, I really thought I was on my way out. I mean, I wanted to be Speaker Pro Tem because I felt that I had done some good things in the body. But I also felt that, you know, that's as high as I'm going to go. Listen, I'm from the PD.
Right.
The last time they had a speaker from the PD was back in 1930, Speaker Gibson from Dillon.
And the fifth. 14 years before, they were Greenville and Charleston.
Yeah, always Greenville and Charleston. So I had this interim period between August and December that I had to run the House. We were out of session, but I formed committees. I reformed rules about how you could raise money,
ethical standards,
membership packs. You know, changing the ethical background of the House, because there were issues and there were problems. So, you know, I took care of that. We took care of other issues, and Gary Simrell came up and because I had not even thought about running. And he said, like y'all suggested, that, Jay, you know, this is your time. You know, you were put here for a reason, and the reason was to be Speaker of the South Carolina House and to kind of bring us out of this mess we're in.
Right.
And make no mistake about it, it was an absolute
it was a bad
mess. So, you know, I was extremely fortunate to have, you know, that kind of support system back then that pushed me to do it. But I mean, you're talking about the guy that in 1998 lost on his election night. He actually lost, went home, and to 2014
yeah.
becoming the Speaker of the South Carolina House. That's why
that's
I
a great
tell,
story.
Yeah.
That's amazing. You know, we had your friend Gary Semmerl on here a couple weeks ago, and just he's got such a great sense of humor, and he described the future of the House. He said, you know, it used to be Speaker Lucas, Chairman Merle Smith, and Majority Leader Gary Semmerl. So Merle Smith, Gary Semmerl, and Jay Lucas is like a three-legged stool. He said, well, me and Jay are leaving, so now Merle's going to be like a pogo stick.
Well, Jay, and that brings up an important point, I think. I'd love to hear your views on it. But the House has clearly changed during the time you've been there. Why don't you just tell some of our listeners some of the things you've noticed about the House, things that have changed. What are your thoughts?
Well, Vincent, it's not like the body that I took over in 14 and 15. Obviously, there's change. I think, you know, unfortunately, national politics wants to try to creep into South Carolina.
Well, we have a saying on the show, all politics is national.
Yeah. So, but, you know, you say that, but look at what we did with the voting integrity bill to get 124
right.
you know, House members to vote for that. So it's not here yet. Now, you know, understand that you used to could, you know, look at the House as kind of like a bell-shaped curve. You know, far left folks on the left, far right folks on the right. But most of the people in the middle were either, you know, center left or center right folks. You know, that the size of that curve is shrinking, uh-huh. obviously, mm-hmm. and the ends are growing. So that's something that Speaker Smith is going to have to deal with. We all know that serving as Speaker is a lot about relationships.
Right.
I was able to survive the 8 years, and the last two were the toughest. But, you know, I did it because of my relationships with all the folks in the House. I don't think it's ever going to be as easy as I had it. Now, and I say that from the standpoint of somebody who really had it hard his first year, because you remember, I barely won my first year. There were people who wanted to take me out. And what happens at the end of the first year?
Well, and then you served in delegation in Chesterfield that was literally all Democrats. The county is overwhelmingly white. The county, every county council member, I was the senator, the other House members, like, you were the only Democrat. Same thing was true just about in Darlington County for, I mean, well over 15 years. When you got elected as Speaker, if memory serves correctly, I know you ended up being the only candidate, but you did a good job of putting together a strong coalition of Democrats and Republicans, if memory serves correctly. Talk a little bit about that and how your political experience helped you do that.
Yeah, well Vincent, you talked about my district earlier, and I like to tell people the reason I don't have opposition is because I do such a good job. Well, you and I both know I don't have opposition because nobody knows where exactly that district goes.
It was
really
brilliant.
It kind of wandered. Well, you know, the court drew it. I didn't draw it. You know, it wanders from Hartsville to Lancaster, South Carolina.
Gosh.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's come back a little bit now, and it's not border anymore. But, you know, the great thing about being in four delegations was I had all these delegation members.
And relationships that you built.
Sure, relationships that I'd built. But, you know, the Greenvilles and the Charleston, they have built-in delegations.
Right.
You know, I think that I was very lucky to be in four delegations because it did give me at least a base of support that I could run mm-hmm. off of. If I would have just been in Darlington County and had my two other delegation members, I don't think I would have been as strong a candidate.
So, Jay, you become Speaker of the House in 14, and then the very next year, our state endures one of the most tragic episodes in modern history with the shooting of the Emmanuel 9, and 9 innocent, beautiful people were shot and killed in Charleston on that June night. And you were Speaker of the House. So the bill that Senator Heen kind of helped shepherd through the Senate comes over to the House chamber, and that had to be – I mean, your on-the-job training is now, okay? I mean, you've got to help heal our state, You've got to bring a coalition of votes together. We remember watching y'all debate that bill late the night you passed it. And yet you'd only been speaker for about a year. What was that like?
Yeah. Joel, that was tough. And I will say this. You know, as Speaker of the House, as leader of that body, you know, after that horrendous incident and then seeing the individual who perpetrated it with a Confederate flag around him, there's no way that that flag can continue to be a symbol on our state house sure. and represent our state. So, you know, we were going to, you know, we were going to deal with it. Unfortunately, you know, Governor Haley had said, I want the flag down. Senate, I believe the vote was 43-3 to bring the flag
something
down.
Something like that, sure.
And the Senate leaves town. And here that bill is in the South Carolina House, and us dealing with amendment after amendment. Y'all dealt with it fairly quickly. It took us 13 hours to deal with it.
Yeah.
We were down at times. We had a tie vote to leave the poll up, I think.
Yeah.
We had, and it failed.
To fly different Confederate
flag.
Yeah,
I mean, they you know, we came this close to losing a number of times. But, you know, somehow we persevered through it. I think I would have done a better job if I'd have been a fifth-year speaker as opposed to a first-year speaker. I remember leaving that night at 2 o'clock, you know, thinking, you know, Jay, you really didn't do a very good job with it. It, you know, the end result was
you
what
got
you
the
wanted.
Job done. That's what
and we did get the job done. But let me tell you, there was some tremendous animosity. I mean, you're talking about some of the best friends that I had in the world. I mean, Greg Delaney, Gary Simrell.
Yeah, they felt
I mean,
strong.
Those guys weren't talking to me.
Right.
So that was I think.
But Jay, you know, it just gets back to the relationships you talked about and how much they matter. And over time, there's been lots of instances with this. You know, for example, you and I and Merle and others were in the Eaton caucus back when we first got in the House.
And I'm assuming that Shaheen never once paid for lunch.
Never. Absolutely never.
I got a story I want you to tell in a second, okay?
But I remember you and I talking during the Confederate flag debate. But this is one thing I remember just about the relationship. So the night that you were debating the Confederate flag, I jumped in my car and drove my youngest son, Anthony, who was probably 10 or 12 at the time, to the State House floor. I had sponsored the bill in the Senate, and I wanted to be there to do what I could do to help. And, of course, our friend Greg Delaney was a very good friend of mine and sat with you in the House and sat with Bob, my Uncle Bob, in the House, was a fierce defender, really, of the Confederate flag, made no apologies for that. But when I got in the chamber with Anthony, Greg was standing next to the podium. He wasn't at the podium, but he took the podium. He said, I see Senator Shaheen's here with his son. I want his son to come up here. And Anthony, right in the middle of the debate about the Confederate flag, came up to the front with Greg, and Greg pinned a little guest button on him for being a visitor to the House of Representatives. And process matters and relationships matters to me even more than issues. And I know other people feel like that, but you can fight about the issues, but if you have the relationships and the process that works, then you can get things done. That's what I saw you guys do.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, you got it done. I mean, another speaker might not get that done. And I'm not calling anyone in particular, but you got it done. Your heart was where it needed to be. You had just the right kind of relationships on both sides of the aisle. So what a test of your leadership. Jay, I want to ask you a question. When you think back on your 24 years, and none of us get anything done by ourselves, okay? We might sponsor legislation, but as we know, it takes an amazing coalition to come together to get bills passed. What are a couple of the things that, you know, when you sit down and talk to your grandchildren one day and grandpa, what did you like serving about the House? Once you get past the relationships, what are some of the things you think that you played a role in that will have a long lasting effect on the people of South Carolina?
Yeah. Joel, there are a lot of things. Obviously the ethical issues we dealt with in the legislation we passed dealing with that, you know, I thought was extremely important. What a lot of people tend to forget is during, I think, the middle of my tenure as speaker, the Jenkinsville nuclear power facilities and those issues involving SCE&G and Santee Cooper, that was, in my opinion, really the hardest issue I ever had to deal with. You know, that's such a complex issue to not know anything about it and have to go in and deal with rate making. You know, we generally delegate that to the Public Service Commission. We were rate making on the House floor, and to call for the resignation of people I really respected because I didn't think they had done what they needed to do. Reform of the Public Service Commission, reform of, you know, all those other agencies dealing directly with SCNG, you know, that was tough. And it really took us 4 years at the end of the day, the Santee Cooper sale, having to go through that process and the reform of Santee Cooper.
It's such a complicated issue. I mean, for people, and of course, Vincent knows that very well. He's involved in some of the litigation. But, you know, people can understand, do I need to raise the gasoline tax or user fee to help fund highways? Or people can understand, we just talked about the Confederate flag, or when you and I first came in, it was video poker, right?
Right.
Trying to understand, I mean, because this is not a sexy issue that when you go to your local neighborhood association meeting, you can get too much in the weeds because you're going to lose people, you know?
Yeah.
But so complicated.
But they're going to know if their utility rates went up because something that we did.
Right,
so, you know, I'm proud of the fact that we were able to, in many cases, lower utility rates after this.
Right.
You know, it obviously had to be paid for. I think the way we did it was the most prudent way to do it after looking at how other states did it. But that was far and away the most complicated thing I did. You know, the retirement system, the retirement plan and dealing with that. I was sitting in Patrick Dennis's office, you know,
right,
Patrick
and, attorney for the House.
Yeah, attorney for the South Carolina
His
House.
His dad a judge?
Yeah, he was. His dad's a judge. Yeah. And, you know, we were thinking about the retirement system and all that was going back in the paper. So I said, you know, maybe I'll get the Legislative Audit Council to do an audit to see who's right. Is our retirement system in great shape?
Right.
Is our retirement system in
about
terrible shape?
Yeah.
So I got a letter, and Patrick typed it up for me, and I signed it, and I think Greg Delaney signed it, Gary Simrel signed it, Phil Owen signed it, and Dennis Moss signed it. I put it in. You know, I want y'all to take a look at this. 3 years later.
It's complicated, though.
3 years later, and I've forgotten that I put the letter in. I get this report from the Legislative Audit Council, you know, that told us, you know, the retirement system's not only in bad shape, it's in terrible shape.
Work.
So, you know, we passed legislation, you know, decreasing payouts and increasing you know, what our employees have to pay. The state puts in. It's too much, and we're going to have to think of an alternative. But at least we have a Band-Aid on it. Somebody told me the other day we're not in the 10 worst states in the country anymore.
Yeah. So I guess that's
progress.
A good thing. Vincent, explain to our listeners real quick. One of the things we like to do on the show, Mr. Speaker, is we like to get into process a little bit. And you just mentioned an agency, and I'm going to call on my friend Vincent. What is the Legislative Audit Council?
It's actually kind of unique in the country. We established many years ago a group that is a professional group, nonpartisan, and works with both the House and the Senate, that if requested by a certain number of House members or a certain number of senators, will basically investigate an issue. It's not so much an audit like a financial audit. They will do a financial audit or have one done, but they dig into an issue or an agency and try to report back in an objective way to the legislators what's going on with that agency or that issue, and then the legislators can take it and work on it. And Jay just talked about an area where it really had an effect. You know, there was a report on the pension, and the legislature did something pretty significant as a result of that. Jay, Joel brought up the gas tax, and it made me think, as you talk about things that you accomplished, I was amazed at how the House handled that, because that was a really difficult issue in South Carolina. I mean, it was literally the biggest tax. I know we called it a user fee, but it was the biggest tax increase in the history of the state. In the Senate,
he's
honestly,
the retiring speaker. It's still a user fee, right, Jay?
It's still a user fee.
Honestly, in the Senate, and that was particularly hard for Republicans, right? They knew it needed to be done, absolutely had to be done, but it was difficult. In the Senate, Joel and my colleagues, truthfully, my Republican colleagues, they kind of used us as a buffer. They used the Democrats as the front guys. Remember, I chaired the committee. Joel was a fierce advocate. We were on the floor a lot about it. But that's not what happened in the House. the Republican leadership in the House took that head on and really made it happen. And you somehow protected your members from paying a price. I am really interested in how y'all pulled that off.
Well, Vincent, it didn't take long it doesn't take long to drive around South Carolina to see that we still aren't where we were back when we passed the increase in user fee. The roads were in horrendous shape.
Yeah.
You know, you've got business saying they might leave South Carolina. You've got companies saying, you know, we're not going to come here. I had one company call me and tell me that you and I represent US 1, right?
That
they're not going to take their trucks down US 1 because it was causing so much damage to the truck. So it was clear something needed to be done. Business was crying out, you know, please, you know, you've got to at least make an effort to fix this road. And going back, it's kind of interesting because I was the loudest voice in our caucus about that. So Speaker Harrell at the time formed a task force. I was to chair the task force. Speaker Harrell had the issues we talked about. Gary Semerl was on it with me. And Gary actually chaired that task force. And I can tell you, Gary Semerl is not only a witty guy, he is a bright guy. And his leadership on that, I think more than mine, you know, got us through that. Yes, we had some members that had to take some tough votes, but I think the really great thing is that we went out and helped them defend those votes. And I don't think we lost anybody based on that vote. But what the Senate did was brilliant, and it helped to sell it because, you know, Senator Grooms, I believe, who's a good friend of mine, but always looking for an angle.
Oh, yeah.
That you remember, if you kept your gas receipts,
you got a rebate. Oh, yeah, that's how right.
And you got a rebate of 150%. Oh, by the way, we're going to cut all these other taxes. So I think the rebate's about to run out.
And it's probably paid out $50,000.
Yeah, probably not paid out a lot. But that I give the Senate credit.
All right, Jay, I want to ask you a question. Because we very much appreciate your time today. I know you've got some things to wrap up as the, you know, the session. Y'all come back in a few weeks and hopefully bring the both bodies a budget. It's going to be really interesting. But you and I did a roast a couple years ago for Vincent. He was being honored by some group, and you came over, and, I mean, I wrote down some of your one line. They were just great. But tell our listeners about the story about the time that Vincent offered to take you to lunch, because all of our listeners know that Vincent likes to be taken to lunch. Okay. You know, we went out for dinner last week. We took our crew out for dinner and they bring the bill and somebody said, "Aren't you and Vincent splitting?" And I said, "Vincent left 15 minutes ago."
I did offer my credit card.
I know. So tell our listeners about that story.
Let me tell you, you're talking about inside dining. It's more of a treat when you go through the drive through with him at McDonald's. And so I had the honor to do that. And Vincent, you know, navigated the first turn and then turned the truck around backwards so my window would be next to the cashier. So I had to pay for the whole thing. And he just had that grin on his face.
Yeah, everybody does it. Jay, we could tell stories forever. What's next in your career, in your life? What are you thinking?
Vincent, I'm not sure. You know, I taught at the Honors College last year, as you do, and I really enjoyed that. So, you know, would always love to teach. Always tell Dean Hubbard that law school needs to teach state constitution again, like Professor Underwood.
We all took it from Underwood.
They don't teach it anymore. So. You know, my law practice has unfortunately
suffered as your 8 years
suffered
speaker,
in my
sure.
8 years. So it's really something that I'm looking to close out and move on to another chapter.
Right.
And what that chapter is, I don't know. I have intentionally not talked to people, you know, while I'm still in office to talk, you know, any kind of interest or.
Sure.
Figures or things like that. But, you know, I'm probably going to be leaving within the next month, and that'll give me an opportunity to explore some of this.
Well, I know the future is bright. One of the greatest compliments I thought is true about Jay when he announced his retirement, you know, Jay and I have been pretty close friends for 20-plus years. I got a lot of calls, and they were all these people with all these different thoughts about, oh, Jay's going to go on the Supreme Court. Jay's got this all hooked up. That Jay's got this. And I told him, and I really believe it, sometimes there are people who just make a decision because it's the right time, not because they have some ulterior motive, but just because it's the right thing in their life. And Jay, that's, you know, pretty much how you've always been. I think that there's a great opportunity out there for you, whatever it is, and it would be South Carolina's loss if you didn't take it, whatever it may be.
I love the idea of you teaching, by the way, Mr. Speaker. I think you would be a hit with the students. I could see that just being great for the law school, great for the students, and great for you. But so, Vincent, join me in a toast to Jay Lucas, 24 years of public service, a statesman, a friend, and just a hell of a good guy. Good luck, Mr. Speaker.
Cheers.
So it's a pleasure now to introduce my good friend, the president and CEO of Lexington Medical Center, Todd Augsburger. Todd, thanks for being our sponsor.
We're excited to sponsor. Thanks so much.
So, Lexington Medical Center, what is it you want people in the Midlands to think about when they think about LMC?
I'd like everybody to remember that Lexington Medical Center is your only locally governed, independent healthcare system taking care of folks here in the Midlands of South Carolina, trying to treat each of you like our friends and neighbors.
You know, Todd, I've had great personal experiences with Lexington Medical Center. I can speak to it because I had a recent procedure this year, and everything just went like clockwork. So thank you for the great job you do, and thanks for being a sponsor of Bourbon in the Backroom.
Joel, do you remember when I was the chair of the Senate Arts Caucus?
I certainly remember that. Why do you ask, Vincent?
Well, one of our sponsors today is the South Carolina Arts Alliance. They were one of our biggest supporters to promote the arts in South Carolina. Joel, they're a 40-year-old nonprofit organization, the only statewide art service organization in South Carolina that focuses on advocacy, leadership, and development. They help small arts organizations around South Carolina with funding, with advocacy, and with putting on the arts. And Joel, you know what?
They are now a proud sponsor of Bourbon in the Back Room. We'll be right back.
Art matters.
Okay, we are back. Vincent, I've known Jay Lucas a long time, but y'all were in delegations together, very close friends. What do you think about the interview?
I thought it was great, and I hope our listeners got a lot out of it because there was a lot of the real stuff that somebody like Jay Lucas experienced in his political career. A couple of memories I have there I think are worth sharing about the person that Jay was or is. We were in the House early. You know, you and I served at the same time with Jay, and Jay sat next to Greg Delaney, who had been Uncle Bob's seatmate.
And for a lot of our listeners don't know this, Greg Delaney was a Democrat when I was elected to the House.
Yeah, he changed the year I got there. We were doing reapportionment, became a Republican. But I remember Jay always ready to leave. And you'll recall, I think I picked that up from him because when I got the Senate, I was always ready to leave. But when I would say, where are you going? He was always going to his son's baseball game.
Sure.
He was hyper-focused. I mean, he worked hard in the General Assembly. Don't get me wrong. He worked hard on forging coalitions, on finding ways to lead on issues. But he was always still very much focused on home. You know, the first few years when I was there and you and I would go out on the cocktail circuit or the party circuit or whatever, Jay was never there. He was always home, which we emulated pretty quickly and figured out that was a much saner way to live our life. But Jay, the man, was always and is always very focused on home and in his community. And in a way, he's the accidental speaker. I mean, I don't think he planned to. I think what he said was true. He didn't plan to be the speaker. They needed somebody who wasn't a policy wonk, who wasn't, you know, the ways and means numbers guy. At the time, we needed somebody you could trust.
And they needed somewhat of a healer slash leader.
Yeah.
They needed somebody who had ethics and integrity beyond question. And if you know Jay Lucas,
oh my God, that's he was always Jay worried about it, right?
Yeah,
to the extreme.
And who
times.
Could, you know, heal the reputation of the House. You know, so, yeah, I agree. And it's funny you mentioned his son, Will, and I'm sorry we ran out of time because when I watched Jay give his speech and I had a chance to talk to his lovely wife before the show started, Jay does have a new granddaughter. And I'm sure that a lot of his time will be committed to spending time with his new
granddaughter. And we're going to get him back on the show, you know, hopefully sometime this summer after he's left office to kind of get a real total retrospective. But one thing that just showed the need for Jay at that point, and he didn't want to go into, you know, Bobby Harrell's problems, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on either, but Bobby got in trouble basically for paying for things out of his campaign account, if I recall correctly, including traveling on an airplane and then reimbursing himself. Jay was so careful about that stuff. He taught me don't ever reimburse yourself for your gas or your mileage.
Or your cell phone, stupid stuff.
And he never did any of that. In fact, a large part of why I never did any of that was because that is kind of how he set the model. I know we're going to miss him a lot in the House. And on a personal level, in a political level, it's kind of a dying breed of the people who they're a partisan in the sense that they belong to a party, but they're not partisan. Like, Jay enjoyed being with Democrats just as much as Republicans. He worked with, you know, the Todd Rutherfords, the Gilda Cobb Hunters, the Vincent Shaheens, the Joel Lurys, truthfully, just as much as he worked with the Gary Semrels and the Merle Smiths.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think I wanted to close on that comment. As I was listening to Jay and just reflecting on some of the work they did as Speaker and where both chambers sit today, let's think about this, Vincent. You got a House chamber passed a hate crimes bill. You got a Senate chamber that can never get it to a vote. You got a House chamber that wants to take some of this extra money this year and reinvest in core functions of government, pay teachers more, give state employees bonuses. You got the Senate coming out on the, you know, the other side of that equation. Yeah. In a way, Jay's leadership has kind of flipped the role of the chambers a little bit.
A non-legislator, a business leader, called me last week complaining about some Senate stuff, and he said, you know, it's crazy, but the House is truly the responsible chamber now, and for 30 years it was the Senate. And I think that's because you had this, you know, and this is my bias, but you had this rural core group of people leading the House who are were clearly Republican. I mean, look, they've cut taxes over the years and all these things. But they also were pragmatic, and as Jay said, they were center-right.
Right.
What you've seen emerge even more in the Senate has been right-right, not center-right. And we'll just see how things develop. I mean, I think he's getting out at a good time because, frankly, I think that kind of coalition building is not going to last.
Yeah, I think Merle Smith will be calling him next year going, you screwed me, dude. You screwed me. But, folks, you can only hear that kind of interview on Bourbon in the Back Room. It was great having Speaker Lucas on. It gave our listeners a real inside look to a man who has committed his life to public service.
It's amazing. I'm so glad we had Jay on. And next week, Joel, our listeners better tune in because we're going to shift gears and we're going to dive right into the national debate that's going across America. Hot, heavy, crazy. Our guest, you'll hear him next week.
Bourbon in the Back Room, that's it.
Bourbon in the Back Room is produced by Austin Shaheen and Campbell Douglas, marketing and research by Holly Van Horn.